episode 6 of Pod Rock. Welcome back. With me is Justin Case, as always.
Hello.
Co-host Ben. Going to be another great episode. We're going to be talking about guitar necks, the wood that you can use or that you might use or be interested in. There might be a little discussion about tone knobs and volume knobs. As always, there'll be some news, and we are going to talk about who I refer to as the six-shot, seven-shooter John Petrucci, the man, not the myth, epic guitar player. So how you been, Justin? How's things going for you, man?
I've been doing fantastic. I managed to cut the tip of my finger today with a knife, accidentally, of course. And so, yeah, it's great when you're trying to learn really, really demanding guitar part and have it done in a week. And, you know, just kind of, that was fun. So we'll see if we heal up in a day or so. It's kind of deep, so we'll see what happens.
Nothing a shot can't cure, right?
Yeah. What kind of shot are you talking about? Jack Daniels, Jim Beam? No. I've been working that and trying to stretch out the old hands, you know, and I don't have the fret span of Paul Gilbert, so it's really demanding when it's like a 7 or 8 fret stretch.
You're
getting into Warren D. Martini territory there. And I did get myself, taking a page out of the Rusty Cooley book, I went ahead and got myself one of those classical guitar footstools. It's kind of comical when looking at it. It's like, what is this for? A dollhouse? And so,
that's hilarious.
It looks like a mini massage table. So, but you put your foot up on it. So you have, it helps you raise the guitar and stabilize it on your legs so that your quad, so that you're not, your fret hand isn't, you know, because really, realize it or not, your fret hand is trying to stabilize the guitar if you don't have your strap set right, you know, where it needs to be for your arm length. Everyone's different. And this bench is actually really nice, a little foot bench, because the angle of your guitar, you could play very demanding parts if it's a lot of stretches and, you know, because it's best to play with your fingertips instead of flat fingered like that and you'd be all sloppy sounded. Yeah, I got one of those, so I've been doing pretty good and learning some new things and pushing myself physically on the instrument, also using a metronome more and getting used to the clicks versus what I'm playing. And like I said, you know, just pushing yourself, getting better, and that's what I've been up to. I've been really enjoying Wolfgang Van Halen stuff. And I got to reiterate, if anyone gets a chance, check out Michelangelo Badio's Facebook live feeds that he does. Like, they're like an hour long, I think. That guy is hilarious. The last one had me busting it. I just couldn't believe it. But not only that, the guy has very good, he's sharing his knowledge and very good advice. And so I would recommend anybody go check out his live streams. They're just really cool. And he's got this little sawtooth guitars. And I think for the money, I actually got it. Oh, that's another thing. I was down at the guitar shop the other day, and I got to see some of those sawtooth guitars. This is not a plug. I'm not paid by them. I got to see the Michelangelo Badio signature model. It has a real Floyd Rose, like not licensed or anything, a legit Floyd Rose, like the nice ones, which would be of the German variety with really high quality metals, things of that nature. And I was very impressed by what I saw. And I think the price point's around $400 or $500. And so I think I might go spring on one of those. And yeah, I'm kind of
excited.
Did you
get a chance to play on it, or did you just get to see it from a distance?
No, I had to go. I gabbed a little bit, but I really want to get the dealer's take on that instrument. I go, what do you think of these? He goes, I think they're pretty nice, you know, for the money. He goes, look, it's a real Floyd. And those are really good pickups on there. I think they're Seymour Duncan.
Well,
so,
you got my attention now. You know how I am about those.
Yeah. So, yeah, Ben, you should get down to the guitar shop. Those out. They're pretty nice. I usually like to see stuff.
So you brought up Wolfgang Van Halen. I'm going to kind of get into the news because he was one of the things I wanted to kind of bring up.
He's been very active lately.
He's super active. He just released the track Don't Back Down from his album Mammoth. I recommend anybody going out and checking it out. Don't walk in, of course, thinking that he is Eddie and plays like Eddie. He has his own vibe, and I'm digging it.
Awesome,
I'm like you.
Awesome
it's it's phenomenal. I mean, just from the beginning of the track, I mean, he put a little bit of humor into the video, but
is it the one where he's playing like 5 different instruments?
He's doing the recording. He's the mix. So you know, great. The bass, the drum. Oh man, and the guitar riff in there is just, it's driving and it's killer.
Oh yeah.
He did a really good job. So kudos to him.
And the production is top notch.
It is. You can tell he spent time on it. You know, he's, and I don't know how long he took recording it. I know that, you know, he said that his dad had an opportunity to hear every single of one of the songs on that album. So it has to have been for a while, I would assume. But check it out if you can. The other one I wanted to bring up for songs was Nancy Wilson from Heart. She released a tribute song to Eddie Van
Very
Halen.
Good.
Yeah, and I sent that to you, Justin. What did you think of that?
I thought it was great because she touched on something that a lot of people don't even touch on when they're trying to do a Van Halen tribute. I've listened to my share of tribute albums for Van Halen songs, and this one was different because it touched on the acoustic side of Eddie, which is his acoustic stuff sounds great, and then everyone, like in the middle of a song, he'll do something kind of out there that's signature Eddie Van Halen with the harmonics on. And the harmonics in that song are like, oh, she totally got it. She totally gets it. You know?
That's what got me hooked in the get go of the song itself started out with those harmonics, right? And I was just like, oh my gosh, it's the perfect vibe for doing that kind of a tune,
right?
Based off of Eddie Van Halen, right? And his style and what he kind of brought to the approach. So I thought that was really good. Other thing I want to bring up today, I don't know if anybody's a Digital Underground fan. I will admit that I bought the album when it came out. Shock G, who started that group, was also the guy that played Humpty, who did the Humpty dance. He just passed away at 57.
The guy with the copper nose?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
both
harm
women and my nose is large.
57, that's nothing, man. What happened?
You know, I didn't really dig into it too much. I just saw it before we started the podcast. I'm gonna have to dive into a bit more.
Right.
Bill Averty from Firehouse. He also does solo artist stuff. I wanted to bring up that he is doing an online show, with a pay what you can. He just wants people there, which I think is great. I mean, he's a fantastic and phenomenal guitar player, in my opinion. One of the kind of true underrated people. They were coming up around the same time that, you know, the end of the 80s, going into the 90s when grunge kind of started taking over a little bit. So I think they kind of got passed up and missed the opportunity. But he's a very talented guitar player. Definitely go and check out his stuff. It's definitely worth your while.
We'll have to get him on the show.
I want to try. I want to see if we can. It would be really cool to get him to talk about, you know, how he recorded some of his sound. He's got this... And I'm dying to find out to see if he'll actually tell us, even if I could just message him and he can write me back. But he has this sound on some of his songs. It almost sounds like a 12-string, but it's not a 12-string guitar. It's a really interesting technique that I think he pulled off in the studio, and I kind of want to get his take on that. So the other one I wanted to bring up in the news was I was reading this article about recording and the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. And that album stands out, you know, to a lot of people's being very iconic because they brought in a lot of different instruments, a lot of different arrangements. They put a lot of different flavor and feel to it. And it happens to be one of those ones that stands out for that, compared to some of their other works that they've done. So I kind of was reading this article about how they recorded it, and they did it all on a 4-track. So they'd go through, they record it on a 4-track, and then they would drop it down to a single track. So there isn't any digital fudging, right, at all at that era, because they didn't do that. So you did your 4-track, dropped it down to 1-track, and then recorded again, dropped that down to another track. So that all that mattered wasn't necessarily all the punching in, punching out, you know, re-recording. No. It was all about the performance and the feel in the context of what they're recording. And Justin, I know I've talked to you about this, my personal opinion on music and recording. You know, I prefer that kind of flavor. I prefer the natural tones, the natural recording ambiance, you know, try to get through the song without having to go back and fix things, because you're only going to improve yourself as you know, with your instrument and on your song, and you're going to learn it by heart. That's why these people could go on stage and they could play for hours, or they could play their songs flawlessly live, because they played it so many times in the studio.
It's a dying art, by the way. A lot of that stuff is all pre-recorded. It's crap.
Yeah. Yep. Digitally smudged.
Vocals
fudging
and everything.
Yeah. So what have you had a chance to listen to that album, I think. I don't know if you're as big of a Beatles fan. I grew up on some of that stuff.
I don't like the Beatles.
Okay. Well, there you go. You're like, next. Okay. Moving on.
No, if you guys have more to share, yeah, I'm not a fan. Never have.
No, it to me, it was the how they recorded it, that album in particular. And I thought that was interesting article to read and find out how they kind of went through it. Because to me, a lot of what I do and how I write is all about the feel, right? There's sure. the technical side to it, and then there's the feel side to it. And, you know, what attracted me to music was how it made me feel and the emotional connection I had with it. So to me, that kind of stood out in that article on how they were talking about it, it was the performance and the feel of it and the concept in the context of the song. So
no, there's merit to that. You can't ignore that. No matter if you're a fan of a particular artist or not, when they're able to articulate things in an interview or an article, you know, that at least they're in the zone, right?
Yeah.
You can relate to that no matter who the artist is. You know, they're legit when they can say things like that. So it's great. And I agree 100% because then, you know, they're actually writing real stuff. And I wish that there wasn't so much fudging of music these days. I mean, you can get any program that will lay out a set of chords for you. And then you can say you wrote that. No, you didn't. The program wrote it for you. Well, it's royalty free. Yeah, but that's fine. But you didn't write it. It means you don't have to pay royalties to the software company. Okay. And there's a lot of that out there. People think they can write songs when they got a piece of software. Well, I just picked these chords. You didn't play them. A computer played them for you. So, but that's another show in and of itself. But I would like to say that real songwriting is difficult. If you, depending on what you're writing, it can take a very long time, a lot of time-consuming effort, and a lot of times you'll get, when you're in the zone, like I've said before, you'll feel like, what am I trying to say with this song? And that's where the artistry starts. It's not contrived. You have an emotion behind it, or you have a sound in your head or feel that you're going for. What chords and what notes can you pick that are going to convey that feeling that you're hearing or that has manifested itself in your consciousness? I'm not trying to get deep here, but I am. With real musical songwriting, that's how it gets sometimes. You hear a jingle, like I heard a melody in my head. I went upstairs on the piano and played it, and I recorded it, so I have it. And that's the thing, is when you're able to hear something in your head and then you can replicate it in the real world, then you know you got something special. I'm not tooting my horn. I'm saying this for the benefit of the listeners. Don't be afraid to express yourself. Don't think it's stupid. Turn off I like what Steve Vai likes to say, turn off the criticality factor, the negativity, set that aside and write what you're experiencing, write what you're feeling. And then you don't need fake computer program. You don't need to roll tape on stage, because if you go to record it at home, you're going to rehearse it enough to where you can roll it and get into one or two takes. And the multiple takes are probably more out of preference than it is accuracy or the ability to play it, because you should have that down. But it's maybe I need to hit this chord a little stronger for dynamic purposes. That's where I'm at right now with stuff I'm writing. And, well, for a power chord or something, I should have hit three string power chord instead of a two to hit that higher end, right? So it's just things like that. It's having that sonic spectrum there. And that's all I have to say about that. That's real songwriting, when you can actually sit in there and convey what you're hearing in your head. And Eddie Van Halen was a prime example. I've listened to countless articles and watch interviews and things when he would be on MTV on Matt Rock, and he would always say, he goes, the fun is trying to replicate those sounds that you hear on the instrument or in a song. And that's always stuck with me. I think I was 17 when I first heard him mention that. That's stuck with me all these years. And that's a driving force in songwriting, is manifesting in the real world what you're hearing in yourself, in your artistry, in your heart, your soul, essentially. To me, that's awesome, and it's mysterious, and how those sounds come about is just very, very mysterious to me, and it's what keeps me going. I think it's great.
Yeah, you got a unique way of writing music, and I think we've talked about that also, not on the podcast before, but you know, kind of covering there's the technical details of things, there's the way that you feel about stuff. And I have a tendency to, when I write things or a riff comes up in my, you know, usually when I'm just kind of playing around with the instrument and I'm just kind of in that relaxed state, not really thinking about anything, but I'm letting that emotion flow out right through mm-hmm. the instrument mm-hmm. through what I'm doing. And right. then I've got a song that I finally have, I think, the rhythm tracks down. that I shared with you the other day, and it's taken me quite a while to get that song pieced together because I've had a vision for it for a while. I just haven't had the right parts to it. And it does take you a while, and sometimes you'll write parts that you think might work and they don't. But I would almost challenge everybody to record those pieces or those parts, because those could become other songs,
yep,
and other things, right?
Absolutely.
Because those are still those emotions, those thoughts, those feelings, or the technicality you're trying to get through, and every bit of it can turn into something else. Like you said, you recorded that piece on the piano. I've got tons of different little pieces here and there that I've recorded too. But for people that are going through and are recording and writing their own stuff, definitely, as a suggestion, obviously you have to kind of figure out what works for you, but save those pieces if you can. We talked about other podcasts using different instruments, maybe different tunings and different ideas, but that creative side of you and the fun that can come with being creative, don't be afraid to get lost in it, and don't be afraid to have to strive and challenge yourself when you do it. If something doesn't sound right, okay, keep working at it, or find something else that might work. So we can launch into the different types of necks and wood. I know that the shape of the neck is kind of what I want to talk about first. The first three ones that stand out are the C, the V, and the U shaped. I'm not a big fan of the C shaped necks. Some of them call them like the boat necks. They push out too far, I think, for my grip. I've got long, kind of scaly fingers. And I know, Justin, you've made a comment a few times about having Vienna sausage fingers.
That's right.
What are the ones that you prefer when you're talking about the three different types? And if you want to talk about some of the variances or the differences between those two, that'd be cool.
I generally like my first real guitar I got is a Jackson, and the neck on that was really slim profile. So I never really mapped out the profile of that particular neck, but I got those Ernie Ball Music Man JP guitars that are very similar in feel. But it's funny though, because a lot of the playability and things from a neck, like I actually find the baseball bat type neck really comfortable because it fills the hand, but that's probably not, it actually makes it more difficult to play though. But I would say it really forces you to play with your fingertips, with honestly is probably the more proper form. Keeping that thumb in the back and always making sure that you can have sunlight through your hand when you're playing. And that was a Rusty Cooley thing. And I also heard it from Rick Graham on YouTube. And Rick Graham is just, oh my, you guys get a chance to check out some of the modern players like Rick Graham. I'm telling you something, this guy is amazing. And he does, he's got a lot of instructional DVDs and stuff, but he does a lot of improv where he just shares a lot of tips like, when you're picking the strings, make sure that you don't have too much pick in the string and stuff like that. But really the focus I'm trying to make is the neck, is that always make sure there's sunlight there. And so I really think that's a good rule. And having the kind of neck that would allow you to do that is for whatever hand size you have is optimal. And I am able to do that. And with the necks that I have, I should say. So I would say slim profile. I know that some of the Squire classic vibe guitars have a slimmer profile neck than, say, like the 50s models, the original 50s models. Like, I've got one back here. It's a Sunburst. And I don't know if that's considered a C-shaped neck. I'd have to look up. But I know that a lot of the Yngwie Malmsteen signature Fender Strats, there's two tiers of Yngwie Malmsteen Strats right now. They've got, like, the signature models that are, like, maybe, like, in your $1,000 range or $1,200 range. And then they got ones that are, like, some Fender USA deluxe model of Yngwie Malmsteen. It might be a Fender custom shop model, I think might be what it is. Anyway, there's one that's like an extra $1,000, but I think they both have the same style of neck. And of course his necks are scale, his fretboards are scalloped, but C shape is apparently the way they were going. And to be honest with you, I never really gave it a lot of thought, but the slim profile neck seemed to do me very well because, and that's what attracted me to the JP guitars, is because I remember John Petrucci said, he to quote him, I have very average size hands. My hands are about the same size as his. So I'm like, you know what? That's probably going to be the way I have to go. And for a seven string, I'm sticking with that model because they're going to be the slimmest profile neck that I could get on a 7-string, which obviously is a much wider neck. But I would say that if your neck is on your guitar is not very thick to begin with on a standard 6-string, it's going to be more comfortable on a 7 because they're going to try and maintain that same kind of feel despite having a 7th string added. So my opinion is if you're someone with smaller hands, look for guitars that have a neck spec of thin profile. Compound radius would also be, for a fretboard, would also probably be preferable because it won't choke out on those upper strings, those upper frets, you know, the last 4 or 5. So, and that, which means you don't have to try and fight it so much like you would a Strat. And that's always been the problem with a Strat, is that it tends to choke out in the upper frets because it's not a compound radius fretboard. So I would say, yeah, slim profile is the best I could tell you as far as a lot of the shredder guitars are like that. Like an Ibanez Wizard 2 neck, for an example, that Ibanez uses, the Wizard 2. And at one point, I believe that those necks, they were making them so thin, maybe in the late 80s, early 90s, that they would snap. I remember reading articles in Guitar Player magazine, Guitar for the Practicing Musician. For all you folks out there who have been around for several decades, there's some older magazines where they really get into the neck issues. I know that the Billy Sheehan Yamaha Attitude bass is a guy actually snapped the neck because he's trying to bend the notes like Billy Sheehan does. Uh-huh. And Billy Sheehan shared that story on, it was a Steve Vai DVD live at Astoria in London. And I listened to it with all the commentary on there. It's an awesome commentary. It's got Steve Vai, Tony McAlpine, Billy Sheehan on there. And it was great. Billy goes, yeah, there was this guy that bought one of my basses, and he actually snapped the neck from bending it too much. And it was funny because Steve Vai's laugh was hilarious. He's like, he thought it was great. So he goes, yeah, you guys out there, you know, don't be bending them too much because they will snap, you know. And that's a bass.
That brings up the good point there that the way that they made some of those necks being a little bit thinner definitely had to be adjusted for tuning, for tonation quite a bit. And like you're saying, snapping, right? The pressure that it couldn't handle, especially with that truss rod in there. I've read the exact same thing.
They're not nearly as slim as they used to be.
Well, and I think part of that is also some of them, they have the instead of just one piece of wood and one neck made out of it, they're gluing two pieces together to make them a little bit more solid, right? So there's that aspect to some of the necks that you can buy as well, where they glue two pieces together to make it a little bit more sturdier, even though it would be a thinner neck overall. But that glue helps that bonding, obviously, with the wood and makes it a little bit more stronger so it can resist that, you know, the
break. Are you talking about scarf joints?
No, I'm talking about like the two pieces of wood. I can't really show you, obviously.
You mean the neck itself, like at the bottom, not the fretboard, but the bottom.
Right.
Wood. Wow. Yep. Okay.
They take two pieces of wood, they glue it together, and then they shape the neck off of that, and then they drill for the truss rod.
Interesting.
You're talking about
a lamination. You're talking laminated neck. Okay, I gotcha.
Yep.
Yeah. Like for example, my 8-string has that. It's got maybe a walnut strip, mm-hmm. and then two maple strips. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Exactly. Oh, he's getting it.
Yeah, you'll see that. You'll see that on the neck through bodies a lot. And nobody can see this, but it's an 8-string. And what happens is the whole body, actually, in this case, they took a huge plank of laminate, and it looks like it's got several different types of wood in here. It's got at least, it looks like, you've got leaves on either side of the guitar, which would be where the cutaways are, the horns of the guitar. And then you've got a strip of that, and then you got, which is mahogany. Then you got a strip of maple, a strip of walnut. In the middle, it looks like another strip of mahogany, and then a strip of maple, and then you've got the mahogany on the other side. And they cut out the whole body like that. So what you see between, like on the top side of the guitar, matches the bottom side of the guitar, and it's just wild because. Yep. You can sculpt the neck where there's no neck plate, and they just lacquer the whole thing. It feels like you're playing a hardwood floor. You know, it just, the sculpted heel's really nice. I mean,
so do you prefer that versus the bolt-on neck? Since you have your guitar out, I mean, you know, that's
that's
a neck through. So I know you have both. You've got that one, and you have other ones that have a bolt-on neck. So I just want to know what your preference was or your thought on that.
That's a good question. I think for extended range guitars that have extra strings, I think a neck through body would probably be preferable because of that resonance. Yeah. That's what I think, depending on a guitar, it really, I mean, I like guitars of all types, but I think for a guitar with a trem, I think having a bolt-on neck is probably okay. But I would think that if you had a set neck guitar, like a strut neck through, I think, and it had a trem, I think that would help with the resonance loss you would get if you're using, say, a guitar with a Floyd that doesn't have a brass block. Because what happens is like, for example, this 8-string I have is a neck through body. You'll see like those little ferrule things that go through the body. This thing has resonance up for days because the strings are running directly through. There's that contact point. And you lose that to a degree with a trem because now it's balancing on springs. There's no longer any contact with the string through the body, right? Which, like I was saying, you can counteract that with a brass sustain block on the tremolo itself. But I think that if you're going to have a guitar that has a tremolo bridge, I think a neck through body would probably be the best, because people argue, well, you can't work on a neck as easy. It's like, well, you shouldn't have to take the neck off, because if you have to take the neck off a guitar that's like brand new, then that there's something seriously wrong with that neck. You're not going to need a refret when it's brand new. I mean, and if you have enough guitars, you're never going to play them enough to where you're going to have to have a refret done anyway. And which goes along with getting a guitar that has stainless steel frets. Those things will never, they'll outlive you as an owner. So there's a lot of different variables to think about, but I think that that's the best way to go, in my opinion.
See, I like the bolt-ons.
Right. You're an ESP, though. With ESP, they compensate. So they, like, you have a bolt-on, but those plates have a slant to them, and they make it where it's not encumbering your hand, right, on that model?
Yes. Yep.
And that's, like, one of their standard features. And I've seen a lot of their signature models are like that, like, Joe Stump, there's a really good neoclassical player. He plays in Grant Bonnet's band right now, but he's plays in the Ritchie Blackmore, Michael Schenker, Yngwie Malmsteen, kind of a mishmash of those different styles. And he's got an ESP, and all his necks are like that. The neck plate is slanted to where it's not getting in the way.
ESPs, you know, like I said, I'm not endorsed by them, but I like what they do, and I like how they build their guitars. Their hardware on it's great. Mm-hmm. The feel of them are great. I play ones that I think I've got. Let's see, I've got one that doesn't have a Floyd Rose to it. The first band that I ever joined, which was a cover band when I was 17 years old, the other guitar player in there had an old Kramer body. That had, I don't know if you know the artist Nagel, he had one of his paintings on, or not paintings, it was like taped on, so it was the picture, but then it was taped onto the guitar. He, speaking of wood problems, he had leaned it up against the wall by the headstock, putting the pressure on it, and he woke up the next day and the headstock had snapped off that thing. Yeah, and, you know, back then it wasn't really known to a lot of people that you just go out and buy a Kramer neck, because I think at that point Kramer wasn't really around. I don't know if they, you know, filed for bankruptcy or what, but you couldn't.
They really were gone for a while.
Yeah.
Because I think Eddie dropped them, and then they pretty much went kaput after that.
I'm guessing probably that was the deal, because he handed me the actual body of the guitar, and he was like, here, I can't use this anymore. If you want it, go ahead and have it. And at that time I didn't even have my own guitar yet. I hadn't bought my first ESP. And that's when I started kind of looking in to trying to find out if I could buy a neck for it. And Warmoth Guitar Necks, is where I actually ended up buying the neck from them. And I think that was kind of the cool thing about the bolt-on necks. I know that you're saying that you might not never need to replace one or get the fret job done. But to me, I think it was great, because all I had to do was buy a neck and then bolt it on there, you know, mount it, and then, you know, you're good to go. You know, obviously you have to adjust the tonation, and, you know, if it didn't come with hardware on it, you'd have to fix the hardware and get the hardware fixed. But, you know, you don't have to just junk a guitar if it's really just trashed. Replace parts on it like a car.
Oh yeah, it's great. You can have all kinds of jalopies that you play, just like look at Eddie Van Halen's Frankenstrat. I mean, that's a $130 guitar. Was it $80 for the body, $50 for the neck? I mean, there you go. And that was even in early 80s money. That's cheap. or I should say late mid to late 70s money that's cheap.
Yeah, most of the bolt-on necks that I like are the maple ones. They tend to be better, in my humble opinion, for that kind of stuff. So I want to also kind of talk about the fretboards themselves and the different types of wood that you could get or use on it. I know rosewood, mahogany, maple. I even seen somebody replace their base neck with a graphite neck, which was rather interesting because then it wouldn't succumb right to, you know, weather and all that kind sure of stuff and get things out of tune.
Right.
I like maple because I like to dig in on my guitars. I like to bend strings, but right, I do like the rosewood just for the feel because it's softer. And I like it also for like the more low and mid frequencies that you can get out of a sure guitar that's got a rose.
Yeah.
I've never played on a mahogany one. I don't know if you have one.
I've got actually my Flying V. I've got a Gibson Flying V with that's a mahogany neck with a rosewood fretboard. This 8-string I've got here is an ebony fretboard, and ebony's got a snappy because it's a very hard wood. It's funny too when you see you're sanding ebony. Ebony is almost like a dust. It looks like regolith off the moon. It's very powdery. Where's it?
Fly me to the moon.
It just gets stuck everywhere, you know? So you know, and as if you were trying to sand like a maple fretboard, if you're going to scallop it or something, you know, it'd be like, you know, kind of like you'd see that it's very, very apparent that you did some sanding. So, let's see. Maple's good for snappiness. It's good for tellies for that clickety clackety spanky sound. So it's spanky. I think it's great. But I like rosewood's probably my favorite. I think it's kind of ugly looking depending on what guitar it's on, but I like maple. Maple's more attractive to me, especially a lacquered maple fretboard. It just looks so classy. You know?
Well, it's smooth, right? In comparison to the
rosewood. It's like playing a hardwood floor.
Yeah.
You know. And you know, really they lacquer those for, you know, integrity of the fretboard itself, because if it's a raw neck, it's not sealed. A maple mm-hmm neck is, you know, it's good to seal those because of the nature of the wood. It's very porous. It has the ability to soak up a lot of moisture. Obviously rosewood fretboards are fine. I mean, I think probably durability wise, ebony's definitely probably the strongest. And what I've got, let me see. So this deck's, trying to think, this neck is this is an ebony neck, and I have another guitar. It's got a carven neck on it. It reaches 3 octaves on the high E, and I can tell you that neck was it's very mid-rangey. That has a two-piece alder body. It's book matched. I bought the body blank from Carven. I bought the neck from Carven. The Carven neck itself is a hard rock maple neck, Canadian hard rock maple. The fretboard is ebony and with a graphite nut, and I actually added on, I have a friend of mine who actually had a block of ebony because he used to repair and tune pianos. I think he's retired now, but he had a supply of ebony wood at the house. He's got different types of wood, like planks, and I was able to use all kinds of stuff from him. And I think that my experience with ebony is very limited, but I think probably rosewood tonality wise is what I really like. And you just, you know, if you're looking for a sound that's going to cut through the mix, though, you got to be real careful with mahogany and having a rosewood neck and then having dark pickups and a dark amp, because then you're screwed. You've got to have a good balance. And that's, you know, I know, Ben, you always talk to me about, yeah, man, you get great tone. Well, it's because I think about what I'm working with. And say, for example, if you have a Stratocaster, which is going to be generally more of a thin, high range, like a high treble instrument, I guess in comparison to a Gibson, right? They always say the eternal struggle is the Gibsons are great and they have lots of low end, but they don't cut through. But then Fenders are too bright and thin and don't have any low end. So that's what you're essentially dealing with. And so that guitar that I built, it's got an alder body, ebony fretboard, and a maple neck. Well, it's got a very mid range, if not a lot of low end of that guitar, even on the neck pickup. So you have to really, I didn't give a lot of thought to the types of woods I was using. I would say, just from logic, right, if you were to build a guitar or pick one out of a catalog as a build to order type thing, I would say if you went with a mahogany body, and you went with a maple fretboard and maybe a mahogany neck, I think you get a nice balance of tone. Typically, a lot of your high-end Fender bodies are alder wood. A lot of them are. But, you know, there's actually a really nice wood that's dirt cheap, and it's called basswood. And I actually, both of my Ernie Ball JP guitars, I have basswood bodies. And it's a very affordable but effective tone wood, and it's available in high quantities overseas. And a lot of these factories over in, like, Indonesia, China, Korea, places of that nature, they're able to get that relatively cheaply. But it's a great wood. It's a very good, well-balanced wood. And so, you know, people should do a little bit of research on tone woods. You'll have your contingent of people that say it doesn't mean that none of that stuff changes. Well, it's an electric guitar and you plug it in. Well, yeah, but tone wood, they're tone wood. Yeah. And if anyone who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about.
Now, you can definitely tell the difference. I have specific guitars that I'll use for specific tunings that I use, just because if I'm going for like a drop D and I really want to bring out that low end on it, you know, I'll use the rosewood fretboard because it has a little bit more of that low and mid frequencies than
it's a warmth.
Yeah, exactly. It's that warmth that I'm getting out of it. So I think you brought up a really good point, you know, for recording or playing live or doing whatever, you know, finding, you know, whatever song you're playing, whatever tuning you're in, definitely think about the type of guitar you're playing. And, you know, like we talked about in the past podcasts, you know, think about your pickups, think about your strings, all that stuff definitely has an effect on your tone. And the neck is just as important, you know, just as much as the body is, down to the, you know,
even the amplifier.
Yeah, I mean, amplifier, the tone knobs, the volume, everything. You know, the Mesa half stack that I have and that I use now on my recordings, you know, you turn up just the master volume on that thing and it changes the way that it sounds, and it affects the EQ and, you know, dialing back the gain or adding the gain. The Mesas really are, you know, they're great because you can get some really cool sounds out of them. You know, and then Marshall, obviously, you know, for me, they're kind of like a loud PA. But
well, I'm going to get rid of that bright cap. I'm going to clip the bright cap in it. Marshall had that.
And the Marshall you got. Yeah. So, but I guess the point that I'm trying to say is that, you know, think about the overall sound you're trying to get and where you're trying to go with it and what you're trying to get from it. Because, you know, down even to the $6 pack of strings you're putting on there is going to have an effect on what it sounds like and what you're doing.
Right. Well, yeah, and some guitars don't match up with amps very well at all.
Oh, no. No,
some of them are just diarrhea. It's terrible.
But it drowns it out, right? To the point you're just like, it's just muddled sound coming out of it because it's not good. Which brings the other topic I kind of wanted to bring up tonight before we get into the John Petrucci conversation, tone knobs and volume knobs. You know, there's a lot of guitars out there that, you know, will come with just a volume knob on it. Some of them come with a volume knob and a tone knob. You get, you know, like the Les Pauls. If you don't see four knobs on there, you kind of wonder if it's really a Les Paul or not, just because it's part of their signature build that they put onto those. I've heard a lot of pros and cons. A lot of people use the tone knobs a lot, but you're also affecting the, you know, the effect of your sound, not just tonality wise, but the signal that you're pumping through there, right? Because that's what you're generally playing around with when you're messing around with your tone knobs. I on the ESP I have, my favorite one, the M2, just a volume knob. That's it. I love it. I don't have to worry about playing around and trying to adjust those other things. I also have other ones that have tone knobs on it. I set them to a specific spot, you know, either full gain or not, and then I adjust the amp or I adjust the sound that I'm trying to get out of my EQ. And adjust it from there. What are your thoughts on volume knobs, tone knobs, and kind of what I just said?
I like the low friction, high speed volume knobs, like the true high speed volume knobs, and have a good grip. I don't like those quote unquote speed knobs that Gibson puts on their guitars. They're just, and Epiphone uses them on a lot of theirs. They're just a kind of that black. You can see. There's the top hat knobs that, remember the old Gibsons had? I hate those things. They're slippery. You can't even grip them. And then the speed knobs, those are only good if you've got low friction pots that are high speed pots. So the whole point with those was that you could roll with your palm of your hand, you could roll off real fast, right? So it's really not the plastic of the plastic cap on the pot that's really to blame. It's the potentiometer itself. They're so stiff and there's no speed because they're cheap overseas parts. But I'd say a good tone knob. My favorite ones are the Seymour Duncan high-speed pots that Malmsteen came out with them. I use the Ingve Malmsteen Seymour Duncan high-speed volume pots. I never touch a tone knob. Why would I want to muffle my sound? It works for Eric Johnson, but I don't play Eric Johnson music. So when you're rolling back on that tone knob, let's say a Strat, right? And it also depends on how you have the five-way selector. Most Strats are five-way selections. Some are three, but five-way is better because you to get the out-of-phase sound, you don't have to try and make that blade stick between positions one and two or two and three, right? Uh-huh. That's what Hendrix used to purportedly, to get that out-of-phase sound, he would make it so that the blade switch, because the old Strats only had a three-way toggle, or a three-way blade switch, I should say, most of them. And so what you mentioned, rolling back the volume on a guitar, well, a lot of guys will actually, there's a mod you can do, and I've got a book with all kinds of wiring mods that you can do, but they will put a capacitor on, I believe it is one of the tone pots, so when you roll the tone pot back, or roll the volume back, I should say, you don't lose the high end, because a lot of times with single coils and things like that, if you roll the volume back to clean up your signal a little bit, like, say you're on a Marshall or something, and even if you have the overdrive clicked off, to clean up your tone, or you can leave it on depending on the amp and the guitar, right? The resistance of the pickups. I mean, all these variables. If you've got low output pickups, well, then you won't have to do it as much, right? But let's say people complain about EMGs and you roll the volume back, you lose high end on the EMGs because they're active, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, all those things, just consider that. And me personally, I like just having a volume knob. This guitar has a tone knob and a three-way toggle, this 8-string, but I've got a black and white Strat that I disconnected the tone knobs on it because there's a belief out there. I don't know how true it is. I know the Ingve Malmsteen school of thought is his are disconnected because it takes away from the tone because that signal is being distributed out to those other two branches there for the tone. Yep. So I disconnected. So I generally don't use tone pots. Like I said, I don't play Eric Johnson music, you know, which he sounds phenomenal what he does. That guy's got a violin tone, and he rolls his tone back pretty far to get that more mellow. He uses a lot of overdrive, but he uses older amps and older guitars, like ES-335s, and it's like vintage Strats, like real vintage Strats. Like, he's got his signature model, but I remember, like, when I watched the first G3 video that came out in, like, 1997 or 98, the tour was in 96. It was the first one that they it actually put out on a home video release through Sony. It was Joe Satriani's Steve Vai, Eric Johnson. And here's where the problem was. And my brother pointed this out too. And he's not even like a guitar aficionado. He goes, that guy sounds really muffled. And he's like, so when you put him on Eric Johnson on stage, they do a three guitar player jam at the end. You couldn't even hear Eric Johnson. And Eric Johnson was wearing headphones because he couldn't hear himself.
Oh, wow.
So it's very advantageous when you're playing on your own records and all the instruments are dictated by the tone you're using when you roll that tone back. But when you're with other players in a live setting, that guy was not loud enough. And it's because he rolled off so much tone that he wasn't cutting through. And I understand if you don't want to sound brittle, but I think if you're playing with three other players and one's got a Marshall set up and the other one's got a, like a Bogner or a Mesa Boogie set up, you're gonna want to have that tone full open so you can actually hear yourself because there's competing frequencies going up, right?
Yep, absolutely, yeah.
So those are my thoughts on that. Yeah.
Okay, it's the man of the hour, Mr. John Petrucci. Big old space silence there for John. Just want to let you know that's what that was for.
I'm gonna be his spokesperson this evening, so all questions must be presented through me, and I will. Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts on John Petrucci, Ben, first.
So, yeah, I'll go into when I first initially heard him. Was back when I was in that original band, and someone was like, oh, hey, you like Queensryche, you'll probably like Dream Theater, right? And they played a couple songs for me, and I thought they were cool. It was obviously a bit different than what I was expecting when they're like, oh, hey, if you like Queensryche, you're going to like this band. They're still in the same prog rock, you know, genre, or whatever you want to say, how you want to say it. I was blown away by his playing and his style. He's very fluid in every riff. His solos have a bit of flavor to all of them, which I really appreciate and I like. It's not what I mean by flavor. A lot of them are very genuinely unique in the way that he approaches his solos. Not every single one of them is going to have a formula to it that you kind of come to know with some guitar players. For me, when I listen to stuff from Metallica and Kirk Hammett, which, you can debate if you like him or not like him, you kind of come to anticipate his style and what he's kind of going to do in a solo, right? He's going to build up and then he's going to top it off with the cherry at the end. I like how John keeps you kind of guessing throughout and you're almost on this own magical journey of music when you're listening to his solos. His choice of chords in the music that he writes to me is, it's amazing. It's mind-boggling how he uses every single string or open strings, not just bar chords. Or one or two notes. He finds these chords in some really awesome places. He's to me a mastermind at his art and his technique. Even on his cleaner songs, they sound amazing in the way that he structured them. I think one of the things that I really like about his playing is you don't feel constricted to chord shapes when you learn or if you're trying to play some of his stuff. Suspended Animation has one of my favorite songs on there, Damage Control, and sitting down and trying to learn the technique just for fun, just to see kind of one, how he wrote it, and two, some of the notes that stand out on there. I never felt like when I was playing that I was in this like, okay, bar chord, fifths, open chords. It was almost like your hand was constantly moving into different shapes. And I found it, one, challenging, which was great. Two, almost kind of freeing, right? Because you're not, for me, it wasn't like, okay, if I'm doing an F sharp and I'm going through and thinking about what notes I'm going to hit next, it's not like I'm thinking about the chords, but, he's thinking about the, either another section on the guitar or where he's going with it, if that makes sense. One of the first songs, obviously, that I heard was Pull Me Under, Images and Words album. It pulls you in just like the lyrics from the get-go, in my opinion. The choice of notes, like I said, that kind of ring out at the beginning, they kind of build you up for this epic song. And my God, 8 minutes and 13 seconds of pure musicianship, in my opinion, it floored me, right? That was like when I was just like, wow. 4 minutes into it, I'm like, okay, yeah, they got to be ending here soon, right? And no, it just keeps going. And I think, as a band for Dream Theater, they're awesome musicians to begin with, and I think that what he brings to the table is just, it's great. It's amazing. The newest and latest album that he put out, Terminal Velocity, I like Gemini a lot because it has just a mix of different styles throughout that whole entire song, right? It's not just a straight 4/4 rock song. You get kind of a different sense and a different feel. It slows down, it picks up, you get kind of that flamenco style in there. It's cool that he can write a song and put it together. And it, like I said before, it's fluid. It's not like, you have an abrupt stop or it doesn't fit into the song. It's dovetailed in so well with the style that he does and how he writes things. I wanted to bring that up. The other song that I like, just because I'm a heavy hard rocker, is As I Am off of Train of Thought. That song to me, it gets your head banging, it gets you grooving, and the solo on it, where it starts off with the bends a little bit, and then he takes off. I don't even know how that man's fingers fly so quickly. I'd like to know how many notes he can hit per second. That would be great. I'm sure if a cop could take one of those speedometers and, clock his fingers moving, they'd be flying. But he's an amazing guitarist, in my opinion. And
Well, he always practices, and he always has a metronome. That's how he
that's,
feels.
yeah, well, and he went to Berkeley. I think we mentioned that on one of the other
Yeah.
podcasts. But
They didn't finish, but yeah.
well,
It's funny.
they still
They didn't
became
have to.
No, they became masters of their own art, right? And I think that goes to show that if you put enough effort and time into it and you practice enough, you can achieve some amazing things. Don't try to be and imitate somebody else. Definitely learn from their technique. Definitely learn from some of their skills. But he would definitely be easily in my top five people if I were to recommend somebody to listen to, somebody to try to learn, even if it's just pieces of his songs or segments of his songs, just to get a flavor of what he, you know, presents musically out there and his creativity. He's amazing. He's a great, great guitarist. I'm glad that he's still putting stuff out. I'm glad he did another solo album. I've actually had a chance to see Dream Theater live, and they deliver. John, he's hardly looking at his guitar half the time, and you can tell he's just got this genuine grin that he was enjoying every moment of playing. And I like that in guitar players. I like that in people that love music, and you can tell that he's generally one of those people that just loves music and loves the craft and loves what he does. So that's kind of my long-winded rendition of what I think about John Petrucci. Other than the other song that stands out is Damage Control. I really, really love that one on his solo album.
I know that the production on Suspended Animation was very dry. He didn't use a lot of ambient soundscapes on the production. It was very much in your face. It sounded like a studio album that was very much in the front. There wasn't really a lot of stuff to hide behind. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was intentional to put a record out like that, but I think that his early work obviously is what made the bug bite me. And when you listen to solo stuff, you can definitely tell that his influence is prevalent, even if he didn't write most of the song, which most of the songs are, at the time were done by like Portnoy, and a lot of the lyrical content was Portnoy. Petrucci was doing a lot of the music. John Meung, the bass player, would contribute quite a bit because he got to have bass lines and runs to that can match the guitars and the keyboards. But the thing about John Petrucci I really liked was I really liked his sound in the 90s, particularly when you got Images of Words. Images of Words, and then what was the one? It had the mirror on it. That song, The Mirror. It was their third album, but it was their second one on the Elektra Records, I believe. It's Images and Words, and then When Dream and Day Unite, is that the other one? Those are the first two, like, full solid albums that they did. Because their first album had Charlie Domenici singing vocals on it, but the first record with James LaBrie, their vocalist, who's been the long-running vocalist all this time, it's just amazing. They've been together 34 years because they celebrated their 20th anniversary in, 2006? No, 15 years plus, so like 35 years they've been together. And most of those are with James LaBrie, which is amazing. And I really like his vocals a lot. He's great. But anyway, back to John Petrucci is that I always liked his, there's a song called Hell's Kitchen, and I'm trying to remember the album, Ben, but it came out in 95, but people criticize it saying it was more commercial sounding. I'm like, you know what? I don't care. If it sounds good, I don't care if it's 4/4 standard, if it's odd time, whatever. If it sounds good, it sounds good. And that was the first album with Derek Sherinian in the band. But there's a song in there called Hell's Kitchen, and it's an instrumental track. But there was something about it that there's these clean parts that happen in the beginning where he's just arpeggiating these really clean chords. And then he's got an Ernie Ball volume pedal, and he's using the distortion channel. And he plays those lines that are just swelling in and just cascading over those acoustic chords, or at least the clean chords. And it's just amazing. I mean, talk about showcasing what a Mesa Boogie,
His clean channel is like, it's like glass, man. It's so smooth.
And the first time I heard it like that was, I wish I had the song titles. Under a Glass Moon, that song Under a Glass Moon off their second album, there's a part in there, there's an interlude part, and it's just those clean chords are glistening, and he's using, I think he used the compression pedal or maybe that Boss Chorus Ensemble in the early days to get his chorus sound. And it was just glacial. It was just amazing. And it just, the production was so good. And, but his kind of, like, just the way he plays and his songwriting style, and it's more than just the shredding. It's the way you can, his music, you can climb into it, and it's got a similar, it has that effect on me as a person, just like Joe Satriani's music is something like, I always said you can climb into the song and immerse yourself in this world for 3 to 4 minutes of where, or however long the song is. They're able to create this world within a song, and he's definitely one of those guys. And I always liked his tone, and he's always paid really good attention to his pickups, and just kind of like making the whole guitar function as efficiently as possible. Like these JP guitars, they use hand cream on his arm to figure out where he liked to rest his forearm when he plays. So they have a very dramatic, this, like on these guitars, it's the most dramatic, at least on the first incarnation of his signature models. It's such a deep cutaway, but for me, my build is so similar to his. It's just a perfect flow. Everything, even the way the knobs, the switches, and everything are all in an arc, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how he designed it, was an arc. And they really gave a lot of thought to this. Him and Ernie Ball did. And just the tremolo is not locking, but it's very... You could do anything on this you could do on a Floyd, you know, harmonics, whatever. Anything, and it stays in tune. And... But that's the thing, it's just one aspect to him I like, is he puts so much effort into his instruments, like what's going to work for him, what's going to have a great sound. And I was a little bit bummed to see him leave Ibanez in the late 90s, but he moved to Ernie Ball, and it was like awesome, you know? And he could have a guitar he could really call his own because the way they engineered it, and it really changed his sound more because then he started using different pickups. He used the... I love DiMarzio. He still stayed with DiMarzio, but he started developing his own line of pickups. And they use DiMarzio Air Norton for the Ibanez stuff. They use a DiMarzio Air Norton in the neck. And then I think they didn't they use Steve Special in the bridge? I'm trying to remember. It's been so long. But he ended up having, like, these have the Crunch Lab in the bridge and the Liquifier in the neck. But when these guitars first came out, these signature models, they had custom one pickups you could only get in these guitars, and there's not even a name for them, but this is what they use now. And you'll notice this has it's got a rail on the front of the pickup, which is really interesting because there's not a lot of pickups that are like that. They either have pole pieces or rails, you know.
It's yeah, just I don't think I've seen one with a rail that far back. Usually the rail's up near the neck.
Yeah, that I've seen. It's really to get a consistent magnetic pull across the whole pickup for. And so you don't need to have like an F-spaced version of a pickup for Floyd, right? Because for an F-spaced pickup, they would space the pole pieces under the neck or under the strings over the pole pieces because of the position, like where the saddles are for a Floyd Rose. That's why they have F-spaced humbucker, right? Uh-huh. Well, with a rail pickup, that magnetic field is evenly dispersed across the whole pickup, no matter where the strings are or where the bridge is, you know. Anyway, that's the by-the-by, but... Yeah, I like his solo stuff, like you said, and Liquid Tension's going to have a new album coming out here pretty quick. I think it's out here in the next week or two. That's going
to
be great.
Yeah, it's supposed to. I know it got delayed by a month, but yeah, I'm expecting it to drop any day now.
Right, and it was great that he did come out with a solo album, his second solo album, because it took him forever to get that one out. He just said because like Dream Theater toured so much that he always would start it and couldn't, you know, he just chipped away at it, and he finally... just said, I need to get this done. You know, I know how that feels. And so there you go. And I really like his ability to share his skills and how, because really he approaches the guitar and the music as a fan. He's not like, you know, as opposed to someone who's maybe like this 60s or 70s rock hero and they know it, right? This guy is a very down to earth and very... he approaches the guitar as a fan of the instrument. And it really makes him accessible in the aspect of him sharing how he approaches things. And I saw there was a G3 DVD that they came out with in 05 where it was him, Steve Vai, and Satriani. And there was a segment where Steve Vai is doing these crazy harmonic squeals on a guitar. You see Bertrucci just look down and look over at his hands. And on the commentary, he goes, yeah. I want I want to see how he was doing it. It just blew my mind. He was on stage as a fan of these guys. And it's great. You know, and I mean, he's brilliant in his own right. And his sound and everything. I mean, he belongs right up. He's right up there with them, as far as I'm concerned. And I think a lot of fans feel the same way.
Yeah, and you're going to find that they have a ton of fans. And I'm not necessarily, you know, radio played out band at all by any means.
And really, like we covered before, guess what? That means nothing now. That's totally not even a relevant gauge of how great rock, like, these bands are.
Yeah, but they still pull massive crowds, man. When they were
New York, they're huge. New York's their home state. New York's their home base. They played Madison Square Garden and stuff.
I was blown away when I saw them. They were up in Spokane, and Queensryche opened up for them, and they were on a tour with them where they were trading off who was headlining. You know, each show was different, and
nice.
Queensryche was the one that opened up that night for them, and I, you know, the place was freaking packed, and I was just blown away, you know, because, I mean, you know, obviously I'm a huge Queensryche fan, and I'm sure we'll have an episode on my thoughts on the band and definitely Chris DeGarmo. Yeah, because Chris DeGarmo was huge for me.
Hey, dude, let's do it next episode. I'd love to do that.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that concert was amazing. I would, you know, hearing bands on an album, like you said, you know, if you're having to go through and tweak too many things or add too many layers to it where you can't do it live, it's almost kind of like a letdown when you see them live, because they don't sound like the album that you come to know, right? You want to go and you want to pay and you want to see them live because of what you heard on the album. They deliver, you know, and I think I have it. Just like I said, my mind was blown to that whole entire show. I mean, they're talented, they're amazing, they put on a good show, and like I said, John was just, I don't think he could hit a wrong note, and I'm sure he does like anybody else does, but he was on fire that night. It was really cool, really good to see, and I'd recommend anybody going and seeing him live at least once. If you haven't, definitely go.
The closest I ever got to seeing Dream Theater live was my buddy Ponch, who will be on the show at some point. He was actually, he lives in New York City, and he lived in the Bronx at the time, really one of the boroughs, right? And he held up his phone when they were doing the Score album live, and he held up his cell phone so I could hear the concert. All I could hear him screaming. It sounded like Michael Jackson. You know, like, ooh! Ooh! You know.
That's awesome.
Because, I mean, that's how it came across on the phone, because all the frequencies go a lot higher, right? It was great because he was just having time of his life, and that's my closest I ever got to sharing that piece of history. It was really cool he did that. He's such a generous guy, and allowing me to hear that. Even, I mean, back then we had flip phones, you know, so I mean, you can imagine it's pretty crazy. But he did that for an extended period, for at least 30 or 40 minutes. I'm like, wow, this guy's really pulling out the stops for me. You know, it just shows you how cool of a guy he is. And he just got a bunch of stuff signed for me. Before COVID hit, he went to a meet and greet with them, and their last studio album that they did with Paralyzed on it and stuff like that, their latest one, I don't remember the name of it, I have to go check it out, but it's all autographed. John Petrucci autographed, it's autographed by him, John Myung, and I don't think James LaBrie was there, but I believe Mike Mangini was there, and I got him signed by them. It was cool, and it's pretty neat, and so... Yeah, I just, like I said, that Hell's Kitchen song that he did really just, for me, and Erotomania is another one, but I felt like Hell's Kitchen was really one that really captured his essence as a guitarist, a solo guitarist, and it's just fantastic. And then, of course, when Portnoy got together with Tony McAlpine and Derek Sherinian and Billy Sheehan to do they did a PSMS record, a live one, and they covered Hell's Kitchen, and it was cool because I was just talking to Tony McAlpine a couple weeks ago, and we talked about that song, and you know, it's like he interpreted it his own way, but I think that's cool because he's playing the song the way it's played, but it had like Tony McAlpine's flair to it, you know, that same exact song that I love so much, and it's just really cool. And I mean, him and Petrucci know each other, obviously, you know, and probably cross paths quite a bit, you know. And it's cool to hear a song that I like so much played by two of my favorite. Those guys are my top two players. They're my top two. And to be able to hear cool stories like that, you know.
Yeah.
Just different things. I mean, it's so neat. And I got nothing but respect for those guys. And I feel like the rest of my life I'm going to be, like, chasing that muse because of guys like John Petrucci and Tony McAlpine. I really am, because they're both just, they're just so enthused about the music and just doing really cool stuff on the instrument. And just, they're both virtuosos in my opinion. And, but it's because they're just master craftsmen of songs and sounds. I mean, you have the shredding thing, but one thing that you'll probably always hear from them in regards to, you know, from a teaching standpoint would be learn how to play it. If you can play it clean, slow, then you can start playing it, trying to play it fast. And I think that is the common denominator with a lot of players, that they're so clean. Like Paul Gilbert is a guy who's probably the cleanest alternate picker I've ever heard. You know, a lot of it has to do with his gear. Like the Laney amps are very articulate, but it's also very, you know, that's enough gain to push through. But
yeah, but some of that is
I like skill, that.
Right? I mean, some of it's the
and
the
it time doesn't matter what kind of picking they're doing. Like if it's alternate or sweep or
yeah
or hybrid, I mean, they can do it all. You know,
you get that time put in learning, you know, the technique or what you're trying to do. If you need to write and do it slow, like you're saying, play it slow, you know, get the speed
and,
up
and
on
get
it.
Get a metronome or drum beat and set it for 47 beats per minute.
Yeah. And I am a big fan. I think that's how I think, instead of just jumping in and trying to play as fast as you can, because you can get very sloppy that way.
Yeah.
I'd agree with what you're saying, and I'd agree with what you said that they would probably recommend. And, you know, starting out for me playing, I had to play slow, right? Because I'm teaching myself. I gotta take a second here or there to, okay, what am I really playing, and where am I trying to go on the neck? You know, where, and I guess this is kind of a Neil Peart thing too. Don't think about the note you're hitting at the moment. Think about where you're trying to go to on the neck of the guitar. Try to figure out, you know, are you going up to a different section on the guitar? Are you trying to go up just a couple of frets on the guitar?
That's good advice. Yeah, always step ahead.
Right. Think about what you're trying to do, because when you get into that motion of, okay, you can play it slow, you're thinking about where you're going. And then when you get that pattern down or that process of whatever you're doing, it becomes easier to do because your fingers will start remembering it. And you won't have to think about it as much. And then you can be thinking about, okay, where am I going to go next, right? You're not necessarily, okay, I'm hitting, you know, the E string on the 12th fret on this. Okay, then I'm going to this one. Your mind's already going to know that. So you're going to be thinking, okay, I need to go, I'm pressing here. Now I need to go here, right? I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. It does, because it's funny because, like, Steve Ray Vaughan, I bought his greatest hits CD that came out in like the late, like 97, 98. And there's an interview at the end of the disc, and he's talking about, he goes, you know, when I'm playing from the heart, like it's great. But he goes, when I start trying to play with my mind and where I'm at on the neck and everything, then he goes, then it just falls apart. But he goes, as long as I don't do that, then I'm okay. You know? And I remember that, obviously it stuck with me all these years, 'cause I remember the quote, what he said, you know, when I hear a musician's voice like that, and they tell you things like that, it makes you sad that they're not around. But when they leave advice like that, that sticks with you. I remember at the time, I was like, you know, you're right. Get it down. Learn some shape. Learn the patterns on the neck, or get the fretboard as memorized as you can. But then once you get that out of the way, just play from your heart, because then that DNA, that vocabulary is there to draw from. And it'll be a subconscious thing, man, because when you get in the zone, it takes that vocabulary that you know, and it can pull more from you,
yep.
Right?
Yep, absolutely. And your fingers will remember it, right? They'll remember those patterns, or they'll remember those techniques when you're...
But they'll play them they'll know where they are, but they'll play them in a spontaneous way that you never would have thought of.
Right, exactly. And you won't get that unless you just, you know, play it and have your fingers hit those patterns or hit those notes. I mean, even if you hit the note single note, one pick, one note, one hit, and then, you know, when you're playing around and you're just grooving on your jam and you decide, okay, I'm going to bend, right? Okay, am I going to go from, you know, if you're trying to bend the 12th fret, am I going to bend it from the 10th fret and bend up to the 12th, or am I going to bend that 12th fret, right? When you won't even think about it subconsciously, because when you're learning your patterns, you're automatically going to know that, you know, the 10th fret on the E string, you know, 12th fret would be next, you know, depending on what, you know, obviously what key you're in. But those kind of things are subconscious, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to.
Over time, your ear will get stronger and you'll know where you... It all works together. It's either your mind remembers or it's your ear. I have to rely on my ear because I can't remember all that stuff all at once. And it's funny because I talked about that before. I had a lesson Tony McAlpine here weeks ago. And I was telling him, I said, like, you know, it's hard to remember a lot of these songs and cram all this in here. And he's like, well, yeah, because... As an adult, you've got a mind full of experiences already, you know, and when you're a kid, your mind is empty and it's got all this extra space, right?
Yep.
Oh man, it's so true, you know, and it's, you know, and it's, that's that, and it really, really, that's probably a good thing because what it does is it makes you focus on really what you need to do musically and you start learning how to push that other stuff out of the way to make room for it, right? And yeah, I mean, with that kind of thing in mind, it's really easy to kind of posture yourself for success. And you see those guys are like, well, I have to learn 30 songs. Let's say, like, there was one guy, I think his name was Jimmy Herring, and he got a gig with, I think it was the Allman Brothers or whoever it was, I think at the time. And because one of the Allman Brothers had passed away, and I don't remember which one because this article is really old, but he had to memorize, like, I think he said like 100 songs in 2 weeks, or not 100, but like 30 songs in 2 weeks, and blew my mind. I'm like, wow, I wish I had that kind of mental capacity. And like, I mean, he was an older guy too, but it's like, I think they developed a technique where they could push it aside and just take care of business. Don't think about anything else, but focus on what you got to learn. And
yeah.
And that's going to be that's really going to be the way things are going now for guitarists. If you're not a solo artist or not in a band where you're trying to make a debut album, you're going to be a session guy and you have to learn all that stuff. And that's just another aspect of the business that you have to adjust to if that's what you decide to do. And just one of those facets of the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'd be surprised what you can maintain.
Well, we're coming up on the hour.
Oh boy.
Hour and a half. great conversation. Good stuff as always. I just want to, you know, give a shout out, obviously, to the McSauce Boys. Chuck Lynch, you're our hero. Greg Atencio, as always, thank you for, you know, listening in, sending questions out. We had another listener, which I'll get into a question on our next podcast. One of my good friends, Shane from back east, who I had a chance to catch up with this past weekend, had a chance to listen to our podcast and is really enjoying it, and our music on top of that. So anybody else you want to plug in here?
Yeah, Ryan McCormick at the Fireside Chat podcast. Been cranking out episodes. He's a great guy. He's a funny guy, even when he's not trying to be. So, I mean, he does a lot of therapeutic episodes where he rants a lot and really lets off a lot of steam, and I can relate to that. So if you're into that, Jeff, definitely check it out, because I know I am. Also, I just, in particular, I wanted to give a shout-out to Paul McGinty, because he's got some really awesome quality artwork that he's doing through the Etsy store via his prints. And I'm going to be buying a couple off of him. The guy does commissions too. He can draw anything you want. Just hit him up on Twitter. I think that's about it for now. I think we, at some point down the road here, we're going to be getting some guests on this show, and we might be able to throw some irons in the fire and get some people from the biz, if you know what I mean, on this show, Ben. And
yeah, be
that'll
fun.
It'll kick things into high gear a little bit, so we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, one other shout out to one of my friends, G. Thanks for letting me harass you with all these different music songs and bands. It's been great being able to kind of dig back into the repertoire of stuff that I used to listen to, that I do listen to and enjoy. And it's great to have somebody else that is getting the pleasure of hearing some of these songs for the first time. So shout out as well. Thank you everybody for listening. And we'll see you again here soon on our next episode.
Peace, everybody.